Hi, happy summer. This is Robin with Cultivated Audio for July 2024. The good fortune of today's guests, Stephanie and Blake Alexander, to have met in college and marry, has become good fortune for many. Their combined family histories in dairy farming continues flourishing today at their Alexander family farms in Crescent City, California. Led by faith and a dreamer's heart, they are the first certified regenerative dairy farm in the U.S. Our other guest, Donna Fehman, has also made a life dairy farming in Nebraska with her husband, Russ. They've been incorporating ozone into their routines to keep healthy livestock and clean feed, even when mycotoxin alerts run high. So grab your earbuds and or a shovel and let's dig in. You both have been fine-tuning your family farm and business for 30-plus years after growing up on fourth-generation dairy farms. Walk us into your first year of your own farm, describing the land, rainfall, your herd, and a couple of the first important steps you took toward the regenerative system you're working with today.
Sure. We started in 1988. In Southern California, down where Stephanie grew up in that area on a rented facility. And so that's when we started our dairy business. We were large-scale conventional dairy farmers at the time, milking 500 to 800 cows on a pretty small footprint and certainly not grazing or doing anything. And after 4 years of that, in 1992, an opportunity of this ranch that we currently call home was for sale, and we did everything we could to work out a deal to buy it, and we've been here for 32 years calling this home.
Yeah, and when we saw this ranch, it was going back to where Blake grew up, basically, his region of the state, right on the Oregon border. You can hear the ocean from the property.
That's amazing.
Just beautiful, all this grass that grew, riparian zones where the cows were still walking through and stuff, but it was just a beautiful setting. And shortly after we purchased the ranch, we became friends with an agronomist. And he taught us about the soil organic matter and to do no harm to that soil. So it took us in that direction first. And it's a unique area where we live. Get 60, 80, 100 inches of rain a year. So we really have plentiful rainfall in the wintertime. We do irrigate in the summer. Our average daily temperature is 11 degrees from winter to summer. So generally, we always say it's kind of around 57 degrees. Right now, it's probably around 67 degrees. While the rest of the state is hot, we're getting the fog a little bit, and it's just pretty cool summers and mild winters as well.
I had no idea that area was like that. It's tempting.
And it's only the 10, 15 miles right along the coast that are that cool. It warms up 30 degrees 10 miles away.
Sure.
We're in a really neat microclimate. You had mentioned Alan Savory, and I had a chance to meet Alan Savory in about 1993 or 4, and I'd read his holistic management book before that, which was huge and overwhelming for me. And so we kind of adopted principles and practices based on that. And in the 80s, we worked with his partner when he first came to the United States just on grazing. I grew up in a grazing situation there in Humboldt County down in Ferndale, California, which is 100 miles south of us right now. And so my family has been grazing cows, you know, where I was the fourth generation doing that. And so we already knew a lot about grazing, and then had this temporary hiatus where Stephanie and I moved to Southern California, her area, as soon as we got married, and kind of tried that large-scale dairy farming from a confinement standpoint. And then when this land came available, it was an opportunity to return to a grazing pasture situation where I was certainly more comfortable.
And it was about 99 where we started the transitioning to go organic. And a lot of that was how do you become organic farmers? And so in that process, we learned about Acres USA in the Midwest. And we attended one of those, and Sally Fallon was speaking. So I became involved in Weston A. Price Foundation. We both went to a lot of sessions, and he got really excited about a book called The Biological Farmer by Gary Zimmer. What was really cool, and I think pivotal to us, is the keynote speaker at an event like that designed for farmers was doctors making a difference in people's lives, teaching them to go to the farm instead of the pharmacy. Mm-hmm. And so Blake, who's an outstanding cowman, really became a soil and grass enthusiast and started just, we literally took a suitcase full of books home that we purchased because we just wanted to learn so much. He about soils and grasses and myself about nutrition. And so I became this nutrient-dense foodie mom. I was helping a lot with the calves back then, and we had five little kids that we were raising and got involved in Wesley Price Foundation and became a chapter leader as well. So it really gave purpose to what we did as dairy farmers as we went down towards the organic path and, like, learning so much through it, too.
And I would add, often people ask, well, why did you get into organics? And I think, like most business people, we got into it for the premium pricing and kind of looking for niche marketing that was a comfortable fit in our environment. And, you know, just making conventional milk from this perspective, this point in the United States, didn't make any sense at all. Mm. And so it was really a nice thing. So, yeah, we were motivated by money and premium in the beginning, and then we kind of went overboard on the education side to really dig in, learn. And I remember making statements a few years in, if we ever lost our organic milk market, I would certainly never go back to being a conventional farmer using the pesticides and fertilizers and different things, because I fully believed in the biological benefits to the soil. And so that was just really important. Stephanie mentioned the agronomist that we met back there in 92. His name is John Schneider. He passed away a couple of years ago, but he became a really good friend for those 31 years in between. And we spent a lot of time together. And he taught us the importance of building organic matter back when we were just grazing as a conventional farmer. And that was really awesome to focus on organic matter. Because later, fast forward now 20-some years, and the word regenerative starts to hit the marketplace and the circles that we run in. And regenerative is simply a new word for an old system.
Yes.
That's been on the planet since the original regenerative farmers that I'm going to say were Adam and Eve.
Right, yes.
Literally the system that our maker gave us right from day one. And here in the United States, we just simply went a little too aggressive in the last 8 or 9 decades, you know, kind of pounding our chest saying we can feed the world. And it's true, we can, but we did it at a tremendous cost to our soils and specifically the biology in the soil. But now we've got a huge awakening and awareness, and, you know, our 30-some years of experience has just set us up in a perfect spot to kind of be in the forefront of that awareness and paying attention. Again, building organic matter in our soil was our focus.
What was the biggest challenge there?
Honestly, there are no challenges. They're just opportunities.
Oh, beautiful.
I can't answer. I'd have to think about that a long time, because it's just direction. We have a saying in our business that we try to do the right thing at every turn. And so when you're doing the right thing, it's not like it's a challenge. You just do the right thing. And so, again, focusing on organic matter meant that we were trying to build the sponge in the soil. And someday we would use less water and less irrigation water during our 6 or 7 month dry season. And so that was the motivation. And then we started composting and making our own compost. And I remember being all proud of where we put the first batch of compost on 40 acres. And then Gary Zimmer happened to visit us that year. We did some soil testing. And Gary says, Blake, it's great. You did a great job, but you overapplied magnesium. So next time, spread that same compost over 3 times more acres. And so that's kind of the formula that I got in my head. Okay, we're just going to spread our compost as thin as we can every year. And we don't do a lot of testing. We periodically test, but again, focusing on organic matter means that you adjust your grazings to grow taller grasses, deeper roots, leaving more material in the field sometimes, harvesting feed and hauling it out as haylage or silage or dry hay is a net negative to building organic matter in soil. And then 56 or 7% of organic matter happens to be carbon. And so boom, boom, boom. Now we're on this regenerative carbon cycle and doing doing good work, even though all we were focused on was organic matter.
Right. So two things that makes me think of. One is there was such a myth going on for so long, wasn't there, about, oh, it's going to take 40 years to get another eighth of an inch. Yeah. And so, boom, you've already discussed that. It was totally a myth. Yes.
It's absolutely a myth. And you know, I guess everything in context, and context means Alan Savory's terms are, you know, there's brittle environments and then there's arid environments that are, you know, kind of wet. And a brittle environment is dry. And so we've had desertification happening around the globe, around the planet. And when you think that through and you learn about this, how do we reduce that? And so what we're trying to do is build upon the systems, the regenerative systems, that, and I just boil it down to three things: the carbon cycle, the water cycle, and the energy cycle, sunlight as energy. Mm-hmm. And maximizing those things are what feeds the biology. And then everything snowballs in a positive direction from there. And I kind of lost track of your question.
Well, I'm here to bring you back.
All right.
It's great because you're covering so many of my questions as you're speaking. But the one thing, you guys have a reputation for being creators of gourmet compost. So what is your kind of semi-recipe? Obviously, every year you're spreading a slightly different compost, right? And so it makes sense to make it thinner. And, you know, as it is different every year, you're getting all the right things. It's slightly different amounts, right?
Yeah. So a couple things. I remember sitting at our kitchen table 20 years ago with some people from the Marin Carbon Project, and that's the Bay Area here in California. They just showed us a slide or some information where a quarter inch of compost applied to the land had a result that you could measure 80 years later. Now, I don't know if they did this in a lab or in their sleep, but the concept I can kind of get behind. I understand why. So compost kind of starts the snowball. It starts the process. And so what we do, we now have about 6,000 acres here on the coast, and we have a somewhat limited supply of that gourmet compost. And so we just try to spread it either on 20 to 30% of the land every year. And then occasionally we followed some NRCS, Natural Resource Conservation Service rules with the USDA, where they incentive grant to healthy soils, and we apply compost 3 years in a row. And that really improves the ground. So we've seen that. We've witnessed the response to that. And the way I measure it is really with a shovel, going out and digging down a foot and observing the tilth and the texture and the aggregation of the soil and the earthworms.
Right.
And so it's pretty simple. Now, let's get back to gourmet. I'll start with, it comes in multiple flavors. So we have a beef flavor, we have a chicken flavor, we have a fish flavor, and then we just have your basic, wood. So we've always said yes to everybody, all the allied neighbors. So they've got fish waste coming out of Oregon, fish waste coming out of the south, you know, in Northern California. And we say, yeah, we'll take it. And you can dump here, you know, 365 days a year. And it doesn't matter how wet and sloppy it is, we can handle it. So we get crab shell, we get shrimp shell. You know, those are seasonal. And then we get these fish carcasses almost weekly, and we'll get one or two loads a week. So 50 loads a year is not an overstatement. And then we have the wood shavings, which sawdust.
We use that for bedding for our cow charity barn.
Mm. Yeah, so it first gets dirtied up by the cows and cattle, and then mix it with our solids that are coming off of our manure separation. That's where the liquid is going into a pond that we aerate, and then we put that out on the soil as a pleasant experience, again, for the biology, because it's been oxygenated. It's not nasty. Then the solids become the base of our compost, and then we're adding in the wood chips and shavings almost at a 50-50 rate. Mm. And then whatever happens to show up in regards to the fish waste, and we compost our dead animals and compost our chickens, and so eggshells, everything's going in at some point. And then this year, or this past year, over the last 6-8 months, we're now getting a lot of biochar, We've reached out and bought biochar in the past, 5 years ago in different places in Oregon, but now we have a pretty consistent supply coming where we're getting about 3 to 4 truckloads per week. These are big, massive truckloads.
Yes.
Everything we get is in full big truckloads. The wood chips are coming in 100 to 200 truckloads a year. And so we are really making a lot of compost. Now we're putting that biochar in at about 10 to 15% rate. And biochar is just, it's kind of charcoal. It's carbon that was burned at low temperatures. It's basically housing or structure for biology. And so it's got a lot of surface area that bugs and biology can happen to be part of. We just are excited this week. We found out that it's legal to feed a little bit of that to our cattle.
And legal as in certified organic.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So we got it approved as feedstuff. And we're real excited about that because then now that charcoal will go into the cow's rumen and through her system, get it all inoculated up with biology. And
feed that healthy bacteria.
And then that will end up and when they're out in the fields, it'll end up in the dung beetles, burying that in the soil. And so there's a lot of studies that as that passes through the cow system, there's some benefits. And it, you know, in the meantime, it might absorb some toxins that she happens to eat in the feed or something.
I think so, yes, yes. Tell us about your herd. I know you have different types, different breeds of cattle, and you are now 100% A2, if I'm correct in saying that. Tell us about your breeds and how you breed for the A2.
When we first went organic and going back to a grazing-based system, we looked to New Zealand because we knew New Zealand was grass-based genetics, and we got a lot of Kiwi crosses in our herd at that time and purchasing their genetics. We also were getting their periodicals, and through that process, we learned about a book called The Devils in the Milk by Dr. Keith Whitford, and he released that in 2007, and that's where we learned about A2. And New Zealand was doing the research, and so we started just strictly buying genetics that were A2, the digestible protein in dairy. And so we started that process in 2008, and we also were looking at other genetics. We searched Montbelliards, we searched different things, and Blake and I, for our 15th wedding anniversary, went to New York and just visit farms. As a family, our vacations were visiting farms in Pennsylvania, learning how to be organic, taking our kids in tow and stuff. So this particular trip, we were looking at different genetics to see what were the best fit for grazing herds.
Specifically, there was one herd out there, Normandy, which
is
a French breed. And so we set up our whole trip to go visit that one herd. And I'm glad we did, because I decided that day that we didn't need to use those genetics in our system. And when we say genetics, we're buying frozen bull semen.
Okay,
and so that's how it gets moved around the country, around the world.
And then we were at a conference and learned about Buckwheat genetics from Germany. And it's a breed that has a little bit of Simmental type to it, but yet it's a dairy milk cow. It's one of the most popular breeds in the world, just not popular in the United States. So we liked what we saw. Blake liked what he saw, more importantly.
Yeah.
And started going that direction.
Yeah, and the real specific there is that Simmental is a beef breed, for those of you that don't understand that. And so they're a dual-purpose breed, meaning that they've been selected and bred and chosen for both meat and milk production at the same time. Everything else up until this breed that we're talking about, which is Fleck Bay, we've always just bred for milk production, milk production, milk production. And that's how United States feeds the world, is focusing on one trait or attribute and just doing it really, really well. And so we're now here in this organic setting, this regenerative dairy farm that we've created, slowing everything down and coming back to basics. Again, looking back to the very first regenerative couple that we're aware of, and you know, what was life like then? Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden and this perfect world that we were given on this planet that was in harmony without pesticides, plastics, and herbicides and all that stuff, right? There's something there that we all need to focus on and pay attention to. And so the cattle that we've selected are now literally better at grazing and eating forages and fiber that grows out in the grass that humans can't eat and digest. They convert it to meat and milk for us. And now it's a very efficient process and system to convert our healthy soils into growing healthy plants that then we convert into milk or at the end of the cow's life, meat. And those products are now better than all the alternatives in terms of nutrient density and the health attributes that come with it.
And that's what's really exciting is the nutrient density. And we believe as we've worked on that soil and improved it, that the biology and the more biology you add, then that's a healthier plant and you're getting more nutrient density in your milk.
I think protein is probably the main thing that's looked at for being a nutrient dense food. Are there other attributes to milk that you're looking at?
Yeah, let me talk protein real quick. Protein's extremely important, right? When you think of third world countries, literally, I went to Vietnam and then these professionals over there that own dairy companies says, we want our kids to be bigger and smarter. And so they want their kids, their children, to grow up on a healthier milk. And so they had invited us over there because we had an A2 supply of milk.
Wow.
So A2 is referring to the digestibility of the protein. And what it's really not saying is that there's an A1 protein that's kind of the devil in the milk that Stephanie mentioned earlier. And that's just a simple amino acid chain where there's a histidine, where there's supposed to be a proline. And so something happened, something genetically went wrong somewhere in the cattle industry, maybe 1,000 years ago, 500 years ago, we don't know, but it's prevalent across many breeds and many countries. So it happened a long while ago. And it's only in the population at about 30%, maybe 35%, but it's contaminating all of our dairy products.
Right.
So people have issues drinking milk. That's the reason milk gives you a phlegmy feeling in your mouth. It's your body kind of wanting to reject it. And then, you know, your stomach may reject it or not, but for some, it's not a problem. And for others, it is a problem. And so now they're able to be comfortable with an A2 milk.
I appreciate you bringing that up because so many people say, well, you're not supposed to have cow milk because it's different than human milk. Obviously, it's different, but the fact that it has the A2, that's the big key. And that's something I think that is either disregarded or not brought out a lot of the time.
Correct.
And I think people that say that information about not drinking cow milk, they have an agenda there.
You think?
Yes. Yeah. Raised families that are raised with animal-based products in their diets, dairy, meat, milk, and eggs, their IQs are incredible, their health, their overall well-being, their happiness, and we've gotten away from that in our country. And then cows being grazing on grass definitely gives it a better, healthier profile. That's the way God intended animals to eat, is on the grass and cows grazing. And you're going to get on our 100% grass-fed milk, 1-to-1 ratio of omega-3, omega-6. We want that ratio, not high omega-6 with animals that are fed a lot of grain. And so you're going to get the CLAs, conjugated linolenic acid, which is known for cancer prevention and healthy everything for you. All that healthy fat is great for the brain and great for digestion, just energy. And your body wants that, needs it, and we definitely need it in our children in America. And so we're excited that we've developed this composite breed that's mostly Fleck B and going, you know, back to a little bit of Jersey, back to a little bit of Holstein, whatever we're looking for, but always kind of going to Fleck B because they do so well on grass.
And yeah, let me just kind of give your listeners a visual of what that means to us. And most dairy cattle are kind of tall and skinny and kind of bony. Not ours. Ours are shorter and in both directions, tall and not as long. And they're wide-bodied and they're fleshier. So they put on more weight. And by fleshier, that's meat and fat. What that really is an insurance policy that they're carrying on their back against bad weeks, weather that is really nasty or you know, low feed moments or whatever it might be.
Right.
But what it does is it metabolically gives them the ability to go out and eat grass and convert it to milk for our purposes with a high percentage of butterfat in it as well as a super high percentage of protein. Sure, we're getting less volume than the conventional dairy industry by like half or even more than that.
Wow.
But it's a lot more valuable in terms of our milk is closer to 13.5% to 14% total solids. So the good stuff in the milk other than water and regular milk on the shelves is just a little over 12%.
So there's your nutrient density.
Yeah.
Right.
So our milk's a meal as opposed to just a
That's what I have for breakfast. My breakfast is a big glass of milk, and that holds me for a while, and then I move on. Yeah, so is it overall that cows that are out in pasture produce less milk, or is it just the way you just mentioned the conventional dairies get more milk, but they're doing a lot of other things as well? They're not just grazing or not grazing.
Yeah, correct. It's a great question, but to set the scene up here, your typical confinement farm has bred the big, tall, long, narrow-bodied animals that have been developed to eat their meals at a manger. And so I use the terms like this. Nobody's opening the gate and saying, go out and work for a living. They're just bringing and catering the feed to them, and we've gotten really good at that in the United States. And so when you talk about anybody who's grazing cattle and sending them out to forage and literally earn their living on their own with less equipment and, you know, less inputs and all that, now it takes a different type of animal. So I think of a smaller animal that can walk further distances and, of course, carry body weight and gain weight and thrive and prosper in a situation where she doesn't have a lot of outside supplemental inputs. And we milk our cows at multiple locations, and a few of those locations, we don't even feed grain. And so that's where we get the 100% grass-fed milk that is super nutritious. That's our green label products for yogurt and kefir and some other things. And then we do give some grain to our cows, but we feed maybe a third to half, 50% of what a conventional farm would feed. And we're leaning on the grasses and the grazing abilities. And so that's why we only get half the production as well as a confinement farm.
What is behind your decision to not do a total raw dairy product?
We certainly looked into a lot of that 15 years ago or more. We made that available to a lot of neighbors, 150 families or more. And eventually somebody got sick and sued us, and we shut the whole program down. So it's not because we don't believe in it. It just didn't work.
Stephanie, Blake just mentioned different products that you have. And I know with your background in food and food density, tell us a little bit about your development of your products that you have in your store and that you sell around the country. Were there any aha moments maybe or good stories with a recipe or finding something out as you were diving in?
We wanted to be unique, and we wanted to, you know, definitely cater to the niche market that really knew the value of great food and also what was best for their bodies, the nutrient density, as we've spoken about before. We wanted to do vat pasteurized, so low temp pasteurization. We know that a lot of people out there that are niches want the raw milk, but we also wanted food safety was number one. And vat pasteurized is the gentle pasteurization, low and slow, bring it to 45 degrees for about a half hour. And it's kind of the way a lot of people around the world do pasteurization. There's still life in it, so it has a shelf life of 25 days or so.
Next best thing to raw.
Yes. Right? Yeah, so that was really important to us. All of our products when we launched were cream top. And we also started out with some flavored milks, but less sugar was our goal. All of our products, other than a 2% milk, we wanted a higher fat product. So our flagship whole milk was 6%. We went to California Department of Food and Ag and asked them to change the rules so we can say 6% whole milk, because there's a definition of what whole milk is. It's 3.5 for California and 3.25 for the rest of the United States. So we wanted to call out a 6% whole milk since our cows were given a lot of fat anyway. And also, people paying attention more over the last 20 years, at least Westnay Price people, we're paying attention to the goodness is in the fat, but the health is in the fat too. Mm-hmm. And we were going after really that market, but also our own kitchen table too. That's what we truly believe in our home, and knew a lot of people would as well. If we wanted to make a difference in the food system, we have to provide that better product. And so being organic for a lot of years, just passionate about organics at our kitchen table as well. On the recipe side, I just always like to look at recipes, collect cookbooks and tear out pages and file them to things I want to try. But if something calls for sour cream or mayonnaise or something, I'm putting in yogurt to see how I substitute our product of like yogurt. Or now we actually launched a sour cream and just playing around in my kitchen. I love to cook. I cook a lot in bulk so that I can do a great meal and freeze 4 gallons of chili beans. They have a lot of ground beef in them.
I can imagine the size of the pot on your stove.
Yeah, they were all full Sunday afternoon.
I woke up the other day and I counted there was 9 gallons of chili beans cooking. and I was adjusting for just how full the pots were. So we're talking 2 large 3-gallon pots and then some smaller ones.
When you're soaking beans and cooking beef and, you know, doing the chilies.
That's great.
That old-fashioned cook and really believe in the bone broths and stuff like
that. Oh, yes, yeah.
Yeah, with great dairy.
I'd like to add to just so your listeners understand that the nutritional goodness, when we speak of grass-fed animals and grass-fed foods, is really carried in the fat that would be in the meat, or the fat, butter fat that's in the milk, and certainly our butter and the cream on top of our products. And so when you start talking low-fat products, you're not getting the nutritional goodness from the grass at the same rate. Mm-hmm. And so we already spoke about protein. Now I'm just trying to put a plug in for fat and how important it is. It not only tastes better, but it's better for our bodies. It should be a good thing when it's a healthy fat for your cholesterol profile. It kind of got a bad rap, I'm going to say, starting 40 years ago.
Yes.
And there's new truth to the story of fat. In addition to that, when Stephanie's telling you about the 6% butterfat milk that we offer up, and nationwide we have cartons of milk, and we're 4% in those, as opposed to the 3.25, which the competition would be at. But we just always believe that the consumer has a right to pay more to get more. And so when we sell our products, whether it's milk or eggs or meat, we're trying to kind of bulk up the package and dense it up and really give the consumer a reason to go to the store and get the best, at least the best that's available in retail.
One of the things when we launched, and it took us quite a few years to actually make it happen, was kefir. We went to the conferences and visited farms. From a Mennonite farm, we were able to get kefir grains in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And I still am making kefir on our kitchen counter still today with those same kefir grains. We have experimented with kefir a lot. We feed kefir to our calves and more importantly, to our little chicks, the baby chicks.
Yes.
They get kefir that we're making with our milk. It's really great for their gut. It enables us to do an organic system for our baby chicks and our egg-laying chickens throughout the process. And that kefir is key on keeping that gut healthy for those chickens. We did launch a kefir last year and really excited about the trillions of colony forming units in it, the CFUs. And we hear from people all the time that are drinking our kefir and can tell a difference. I highly recommend to people, if you're having any gut problems, before you brush your teeth at night and you're going to bed, have a glass of kefir and let that be the thing that settles in your gut during the night.
Wonderful suggestion. Yes, yes.
I love sharing that with people. We want them to be healthy. We want America to be healthier.
Yes. Well, you're certainly a shining example and doing wonderful work for all of us in that end. Just to share a number, how many cows do you have and how much milk do you produce in a year, would you say?
Yeah.
Just to blow our minds a little here.
Calculator here. So in total, we have 9,000 animals, and that's from baby calves that are born this morning all the way through to the oldest cow on the ranch. Her birthday's on the 22nd of this month, and she's going to be 15 years old.
Oh.
That's really cool.
Yes.
So again, about half of those are mature cows that have lactated and given milk. So somewhere close to 4,500 to 5,000 mature cows. And we milk maybe 4,200, 4,300 of those every day. The rest are dry cows getting ready to have their next baby. And we're making about 20,000 gallons of milk that we can sell. We're making another 1,200, 1,500 gallons that we're feeding to the calves.
Right.
But we also feed a lot of calves, and we milk a lot of cows just for that.
And we're on 5 dairy facilities, so separate facilities that work well with the grazing system.
How many people work in your entire organization?
We have about 160.
And I just did a little math, though. That's a little over 7 million gallons of milk per year.
Speechless.
I used to be embarrassed how big we are because I just love that I met this guy from this cute little grazing dairy. Yeah.
Well, you know, sometimes when you're doing the right thing, it happens all for a great reason. And I can't help but think that's what's happening here.
Yeah. And our marketing gal, she convinced me, too, that, you know, you're making a difference in the food system. And that's our goal.
Right. Share that.
You know what we're doing that's so good.
Yeah. Were there or are there naysayers saying it isn't possible for large farms to operate regeneratively? And what stands out for you as either a challenge or a success in your growth?
Off the cuff, I can't think of the naysayers, but that could be because I have a real personal habit of only remembering positive things.
Good example.
So I'm involved with a California group that's charged with the task of defining regenerative agriculture and what that means and kind of writing policy and procedures for the state of California. And so a lot of people have weighed in. Most of them are pro and in favor of regenerative movement. I think it's as simple as this, that most large-scale farmers just haven't been exposed to the concepts generally. Right. They're getting there, and more and more are coming along. There's a lot of really awesome podcasts that I listen to about regenerative principles and practices and farmers, and the word is getting out there. I was driving to Sacramento here 3 weeks ago to one of those committee meetings, listening to a couple podcasts, and they both referenced this committee in California writing the rules, and one of them was a farmer from Pakistan, if you could imagine that, literally talking about the meeting that I'm driving to. The world is watching.
Yes, beautiful.
So the naysayers are just simply, I don't think they're out there. Once you are exposed to the principles and the understanding, how can you argue?
Yes.
Good to keep the biology alive.
Right.
But what's happened is the farming, you know, I'm in my 60s, and when I grew up, farming was just about dirt was soil, and it was sand, silt, and clay. And now it's no longer sand, silt, and clay. It's biology, it's bacteria and fungi and a whole lot of other little things that are really helping break down that sand into silt, ultimately,
right,
or make those nutrients available for plants and the roots. And they have all these little relationships,
yes,
between the biology, the fungi, and the root that is really getting the mineral out of the sand, silt, and clay, out of the soil, into the plant that is ultimately biologically available for the cows and the people now to eat. When I say biologically available, when consumers go to the store and buy tablets of supplements, they aren't biologically available to their gut. So they may consume that and utilize 20% of the product, and the rest is going down the toilet.
Right.
And so when you can make it biologically available through our food, now it's 100% available or 90% available to our bodies. And that's where, and Stephanie makes the comment, go to the farm, not the pharmacy, to get your nutrition,
right,
and ultimately to get your health. We've just strayed a long ways away from that.
We had a customer reach out, and they said that they were a raw milk customer for a lot of years, and they lost their raw milk supply, so they went ahead and started buying our milk because they heard about it. And they said within 4 months, they could tell a difference. They all felt better. They all felt healthier. They were big milk drinkers.
Right.
And what a difference, they said, in the way our milk vat pasteurized, and they were just feeling so much better. And I think that sums up what Blake stated.
Right.
They were slightly intolerant to the A1 that was probably present in their raw milk supply. Mm,
probably right, yes.
And what were the cows eating? And they mentioned the cows were eating grain and they were buying our 100% grass-fed.
Oh, yes.
You know, that just resonates truth with me in my heart that we're doing the right thing.
Absolutely, yes.
And for the naysayers on doing the right thing. And Blake, when the kids were growing up, he would say, when the kids would complain about something or somebody said something to him, it's like, well, just be nice and work harder to prove them wrong that, you know, you're a good person or we're doing a great job. And
right.
And we just, you know, need to keep doing the right thing, keep doing the good, telling the good. And so naysayers will be naysayers in the
yes
room.
Yes. Well, speaking of, I don't feel the need for you two to defend yourselves, obviously, because what you're doing and pursuing works. It works quite well. The evidence is everywhere, from your soil to your customers that are telling you how much they appreciate your product and feel so much better. With all the recent media attacks on sick cows and chickens, which applies to the industrial world of farming in my mind, but of course never mentioned, I'd love to hear any comments either of you or maybe both of you might have. You know, we can just chalk it up to that's the mainstream media. That's what they do, right?
Yeah, like Stephanie had mentioned earlier, there's always an agenda.
Yes.
What the agenda is.
Yes.
Was the author a, you know, self-proclaimed vegan? And often that's the case. Animal agriculture is kind of messy on a day-to-day point of view, right? And so at any point in time, depending on what direction you look, you might see something that doesn't look right, right? A dead animal or a compost pile or whatever it is. And so there's a lot of beating hearts out here on our farm, and we have a tremendous responsibility to take care of those, mostly girls, and feed them and care for them. And, you know, and of course they take care of us. And so we have a really excellent relationship with our animals, and it's giving in both directions. You know, I think the industry takes and gets a black eye. You know, they want to blame global gas problems on greenhouse gases on cattle. And it's, I think often it's unfair. They contribute, but we as regenerative farmers, and at the pace we're doing and what we're doing, we're sequestering much more carbon and gas potential than we're releasing. And so we are the solution. Our cows are part of the solution, not the problem.
The agenda. And to demonize all animal agricultures out there, to demonize healthy eating. When COVID struck, I was shocked and really just dismayed that nobody was out there on the media telling drop processed foods, drop sugar out of your diet, do this to support your immune system. It wasn't anywhere.
Yeah.
But get the jab.
Right.
Zinc, vitamin D, and boron, and, you know, you'll be healthy.
Yes, yes. And we need the boron for absorbing the vitamin D, which is kind of a new fact, right? I mean, it's been known about forever, but...
And it's all got to be in harmony, right? As opposed to what we've been doing. You know, the harmony is the biology, folks.
Yes.
The cow's gut and the soil's gut.
Yes. The TV out there as it is today is not telling truth anymore and is not making us better or healthy. It's answering to shareholders who are all about profit.
Yes, yes.
And those of us farmers who are doing it right and all throughout communities in America, you know, I urge your listeners to find that neighbor, to find them, and I'm sure they do. But it's the little kids on the schoolyard I worry about.
I know.
Community.
Yeah, I know. Well, Regen Ag is cooperatively based from the soil on up to selling your neighbor's beef like you do in your Alexander Farm store. Is there an aspect to regenerative farming that isn't initially obvious but has become so to you?
Yeah, I'm thinking now of our good friend Will Harris out of White Oak Pastures in Bluffton, Georgia. I went out to see him about 3 months ago, and it's my second trip there. And he's now getting more and more famous. He was on the Joe Rogan Show twice last year.
Oh, great. He was on mine first year.
Yeah, he's just a really neat character.
Yes.
I've been watching him and known him for a good 10 years or better, and we have a lot in common, and yet he's taken it to a whole new level, right? In his world now, it's about regenerating community and regenerating his little town of Bluffton, Georgia, and the surrounding communities. And so, you know, I mentioned three cycles that all had to do with the environment, that the fourth cycle would be the cash flow, the cash economy of our neighborhood and the health of our air quality that, you know, our neighbors are breathing. And our neighbors might be China, right? So it's globally affecting everything. And, you know, I watched that silly debate with our presidents last week, and there was a perfect opportunity to say regenerative agriculture will do more for climate change than anything else on the planet.
I know. I feel like I'm standing here, one person with a little flag saying that same thing when everyone's going, we have to get rid of the oil or...
Right. They're all looking in the rearview mirror and they're not learning their lessons.
Right. Yes.
And so somehow we got to communicate and get this message out.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly with Blake about our just rural community, rural revival is so important, just even across America. The other thing I know, when we started learning about the soils, we also were paying attention to our riparian zones and planting trees and fencing them off. And as we built it, they came, the bald eagle nests came, the Roosevelt elk came to the farm, the frogs were everywhere. We had something to do with the endangered species Aleutian Canadian goose that is now a hunted species in the western region. And so it's just really exciting to see that process. As we loved our nature and our environment more, it just gave back to us too. And so Sunday afternoons are great. We go for a drive. We walk riparian zones. Blake shows me something going on. It's really fun.
Yeah. And that actually, maybe you've totally answered that question, but my last question was to be about at the end of the day, when your necessary details have been attended to and your business numbers are done and scientific tests are done, what is your visual to show you that your efforts are what they are and beautifully working and satisfying?
So, Robin, let me just be really clear. That day doesn't exist where we get to the end of the day and all of your things have been...
Well, I just meant done for that time.
Yeah. Every day we got to call it quits at some point because our bodies give out.
Yes.
And so this is a life work. And we have built a pretty large machine, a large business that, you know, we've got five kids. Three of them are full-time employees. And one's part-time, and they've got a lifetime or two in front of them as well of just caring for our land and our animals. And it's a complex equation. And so every day we do our best, and there's always room for improvement, and we are improving, and we're measuring those responses. And, you know, that organic matter 30 years ago that was 2 or 3% in our soils is now 12 to 15%. And so it's working, and we've sequestered literally 100 tons of carbon per acre or some ridiculous number. So we're building soil. Our ranch is literally getting taller, maybe 1 inch per 5 years or 10 years, right? We're literally building soil. So we're not contributing to, you know, wind and water erosion and environmental degradation of water streams and things like that.
I would also add, at the end of the day, we're strong in our faith. We really have a purpose here and understand the meaning of life and why we do what we do. And for us, it's to serve him in a way of serving his people and having a better food system. And at the end, when I meet, or we meet our maker and his son, I want to hear, well done, my good and faithful servant.
Beautifully said. I appreciate so much your time and everything you've shared, and what a wonderful inspiration. And speaking of inspiration, Stephanie, I read one of your blog posts, and I think it was the one that was a day in the life on the dairy farm, and you quoted a little verse, and I wondered if you could tell me where that's from.
Jesus Calling by Sarah Young. And it's funny, I read this, it wasn't a verse, but it was in reference I kind of get teared up reading this. Just opportunities come towards us, and they scare me sometimes. Growth scares me. I deal with the bills. And I read this the next morning, that I may infuse with you a dream that seems far beyond your reach. You know that in yourself you cannot achieve such a goal. Thus begins a journey of profound reliance on me. It is a faith walk, taken one step at a time, leaning on me as much as you need. This is not a path of continual success, but multiple failures. However, each failure is followed by a growth spurt, nourished by increased reliance on me. Enjoy the blessedness of a victorious life through deepening your dependence on me. And I end with, all is quiet, my heart is full. It's really meaningful, and that's become my life for the last 36 years. I may read a dreamer, a visionary, and I just have to trust God that we're doing the right thing. And I ask for wisdom all the time, too. And he certainly has given us all the signs, our story, his glory.
Donna, you and Russ, your husband, have been dairy farming in Nebraska for over 40 years. And beside using regenerative practices, you have, in my mind, taken yet another step in caring for your animals and your land. What was your original impetus to use ozone on your farm?
We had a machine that we used in the house for our personal health, and I was in charge of all the baby calves, and we were trying to figure out a way, okay, we got this bad time with diarrhea or scours or crypto, and the vets, oh, keep giving them this pill or keep mixing this with it. We didn't have any luck. So we decided, well, let's just start ozoning the water and mixing the milk then, putting our powder in and mixing the milk. And that really started helping us. But we found out that the ozone in the water only lasts a certain amount of time. And by the time I got the last calves fed, there wouldn't be much ozone left in it. So I had to do smaller batches. And my husband really got a well-trained nutritionist on his side. And he does a lot of nutritional things for our cattle that just has beefed it up. So that helped my calves too. But the ozone water was just basically our start. And then we decided, instead of coming to the house, the ozone water, taking it back to the barn, we decided to just invest in one for the barn, a machine.
Yes.
So that's so, how it all started.
All right. And then where did you go from there? Did it develop into much more than you ever even imagined?
You know, we'd call the vet, and yeah, we'd take animals to the vet, and they would say, okay, this cow's got this, and they'd give you medicine. And there's some of these animals that just wasn't coming around. So we would just make a special pen and put just the ozone gas in their ears, and it would just get them over the edge. We had sheep at one time. We kind of had about everything at one time or another, but our boys were younger. We wanted something for them to do. So we lambed out, and we had bought some ewes. And some of these lambs were getting born, and they were just so weak, and they wouldn't nurse. Boys had to go up and bottle feed them. So one morning, I just took the ozone machine up there, and I started putting the ozone in these little lambs' ears a couple times a day. Well, after a couple days, these lambs were up and running with mama and just nursing like heck. But there again, we did find out that the mothers that we purchased were low in mineral. So nutrition, again, if the mothers would have been fed right, we wouldn't have had a problem. But the ozone took care of the problem after the fact.
Yes.
We got the lambs up and running and healthy, and then we could fix the problem the other way. That's what we did with our sheep.
Yes, and it didn't take doing ozone for their entire first year or anything. It just
just a couple days.
Yeah,
I went up
amazing.
A couple times a day and put it for each lamb, maybe 20 seconds in each year.
It's like children, isn't it? When we
yes.
do ozone for children, just a little bit in the ears, wow, goes
yep,
a long way.
You don't want to do too much. Or they start sneezing, and you can tell. When an animal gets too much ozone, they'll start shaking their head like crazy.
Mm.
you'll know, okay, they're done.
And then you've used it on your cows, and tell us about some of that.
Well, in our dairy cows, I guess, first of all, we had this calf in the pasture. It was a heifer. We grew up our calves so we could breed them and raise our own milk cows. This calf in the pasture, Russ went out and found it just standing in the corner with his head pushed against the corner of the pen. And we got to looking at it, and it was blind. Couldn't walk, couldn't find food, couldn't find water. Well, we called the vet because there was no way we could load this thing. So we walked it to the barn, and he said, well, without blood work, I really can't tell you exactly what it has, but these are the symptoms. And he gave us a temporary diagnosis, what we think it was, and he says, that calf will never make it. It's blind, it can't find food and water. You'll have to euthanize it. So then again, we went ahead and just kind of pushed it up into the head gate and took our ozone machine and put it in its ears. And on that calf, I think we did it 3 or 4 times a day. And I did it for a couple minutes each time. And after a couple days, it was acting like it could see a shadow. Well, after a week, this calf was back eating, back drinking, and we put it back with the herd.
I know you've had experience using ozone yourself and with your family for health care, but did it just blow your mind that this calf just came back and could see again?
When it was totally blind, and the vet said, there's no hope.
Right.
He says, we cannot give you anything for it. And it wasn't because he reassured us, it's not pink eye. It's not something that got in its eye. It was in its head. We didn't take it back into the vet or anything. We just put it back with the herd. So so the time we did have the vet out with our dairy cows, it was, for about 2 weeks, we had this older cow. She had one more calf to have, and she started coming into the barn and just wheezing the whole time, all day long. You'd walk past her, so she kind of got the name Wheezy. And she got slower and slower, and after a few weeks, we thought, okay, this isn't good. We better call the vet out here. Our farm vet came out, and he listened to her lungs with a stethoscope, told us that the best thing for her would be to euthanize her. She has a quarter of one lung left that is working. Everything else has shut down. So he didn't give us a diagnosis of cancer or lung disease. He just said, they are not working. He's got a quarter left. So we looked at each other after he left, and we said, well, what do we got to lose? And this was like 15 years ago, probably. I had heard where I bought my ozone machine from that you could bubble ozone through olive oil, and it makes a terpene gas and a highly ozonated ozone of O8. So we thought, okay, we're going to try it. This cow was a very tame cow. She comes in the barn first, so she stood in the front stall. And I just stood up there with the machine, turned it on, and bubbled it through the olive oil and held it by her nose. She just stood there and let it run right into her nose, and she just breathed normal, or wheezed. And after about the third time, we're sitting there going, well, she's not fighting it, that's for sure. So we hung the hose up on the wall and let it hang down right close to her. She literally stuck her face right over next to it and put her nose right on the tube the whole time we milked her. She loved the smell. She knew it made her feel good, and she did not move. It took us probably, I would say 3 weeks of doing it twice a day, and there was no wheezing after that. She had another calf and kept her for a year and a half before it was her time to leave the farm. That was an amazing story of using the olive oil.
Yes. When you first introduced this protocol to your vet, was he already aware of it?
They didn't know anything about it. And when we tell them what we do, they go, well, you can just do what you think you need to do. You know, he wasn't aware that we didn't euthanize her. We just went on, and he just figured we did. And we kind of tell them a few of the things that we do, but they know nothing about the ozone or the holistic kind of ways with the ozone gas or breathing it.
And so you said that your husband found a good vet that really, I'm assuming in saying that, he worked a lot with minerals and nutrition.
He found a good nutritionist.
Oh, a good nutritionist.
He just helps him formulate such good nutrition, and he balances everything. My husband is great at reading cattle. He can look at that cow, and I can think it looks perfectly fine.
Oh, wow.
And I mean, Russ can say, nope, it's getting sick. It's getting sick. He can pick a cow that's coming in heat or getting sick a day before anybody else that I know of. He's got a good eye.
Yes.
And he really reads the cattle well, but he also reads the bunk, and he does all the rations, and his nutritionist knows that he's very good at that. So when Russ calls and says, hey, I've got this pen of cattle, they're not coming up to the bunk as good as I want them to. They're just coming up, but they're not as aggressive. Okay, back them down on this, take them up on this. Let's take this mineral up. Let's take this one down. He's just very good, and they work great together.
Amazing. So is this nutritionist usually a nutritionist for animals or for humans?
Yes.
For animals.
For animals.
Great. Okay.
He has his own mill up in South Dakota. He ships down everything that we need.
Beautiful. So you said that in using the ozone, you use it for your animals, and you mentioned the water. Is that how you work with the ozone with agriculture, or is there more to this story as well?
Well, like I said, the ozone in water is not really stable, but hydrogen peroxide is an O3. So that's what we use a lot for the rest of the watering system on our farm. We have a constant drip into our watering system. I take care of the baby calves up to about weaning age, and then my husband takes over and he does the older animals. And that's a way that we can get a constant O3 into every animal is through a hydrogen peroxide drip.
So are other farmers in your area, or as far as you know, nationwide, doing this kind of protocol?
There's quite a few of them, especially dairies, doing the O3, the peroxide drip, into their water system. I know a couple hog farms that do it.
Mm.
And our son runs an electrical business and a plumbing business, and he'll set you up. He's got the pumps and stuff like that to put your water system in.
Well, certainly would benefit any type of land and or agriculture and animal
right.
farm, wouldn't it?
Yes, it does.
Beautiful. Where are you all located in Nebraska?
We're in South Central Nebraska, about 50 miles south of the interstate.
Well, Donna, is there anything else you'd like to share about doing ozone?
A few years back, we had, well, maybe more than a few, maybe about 7 years ago, the climate in this area made the corn get a mycotoxin in it. There was a lot of humidity and there was hail around, so it nicked corn, and there was a lot of mold and mycotoxins when people harvested their corn. So we were put on alert, being a dairy, that we cannot give any of this corn with mycotoxins to our cattle. It'll
sure.
come through to the milk, and it cannot be sold because it'll go into the humans then.
Right.
Well, we had just purchased some grain, and we got in our first loads, and there was only 1,900 bushels in our drying bin, so we thought, well, we better get this tested before we grind any to get to our cows. 30 miles north of us, we have a city up there in Hastings that they tested it, and they go, wow, this is high. This is very high in mycotoxins. You cannot feed this to your dairy cattle, because they knew what kind of cattle could have it and what couldn't. They said, no, this is not even close to being good for dairy cattle. So we took the ozone machine out there, turned on the fan, and probably three different days in a row, I turned on the ozone machine and I let the fan suck in the air, and it has the drying floor on it. So it sucked it in and goes all the way through the corn. I mean, it just flushed it for about 2 hours for 3 days in a row. So I took a sample back up to the same place, and I didn't tell them what I did. I just right. wanted to see what they what their thoughts were. And they tested the corn, and they said, wow, this batch is good. This is really, really good corn. You can go ahead and use this. So,
and then did you tell them?
We took out all the mycotoxins out of that. So we weren't afraid of whatever kind of corn we were going to buy from the local farmers that year, because we knew that the ozone would take any of the toxins out of it. So that's one of the times we did have proof.
Yes.
And
yes.
there was another time when there was a lot of rain around, and this friend of ours had water ran down in their basement. And I mean, there was 6 inches of water everywhere. So they sucked it out, dried it out, aired it out. They had A1 cleaning come in, and they said, wow, your mold is high, extremely high in here. We're going to have to tear out the walls, the flooring, everything. They had a family crisis at that time, and they had to go out of town. So I told them, hey, can I help you take care of that? I have an idea. So I took my ozone machine up there, and one of their neighbors helped me. I went up and I turned it on, and I said, in 2 hours, go back and shut this off and just let everything alone. Just let it there, because we're going to do this for a while. So that week, I think we did it three or four maybe times. We kind of moved it around a little bit in the basement, because they had a couple different rooms, make sure it got everywhere. And about 2 weeks later, A1 cleaning came back, because they said, now we want you to test everything just to make sure. And they came back and they go, there is no mold anywhere in this basement. We put our meter out in every room, in every corner, and we could not find anything. I think you're good. Yeah. I've always known that the ozone will kill funguses, molds, bacterias, parasites. And just like, hey, why not? Let's just try this. It's always been like that, you know, on the farm. We don't treat a lot of animals like that. I think it's mainly because of Russ's ability to
right. Sounds like
see it. The animals, get in contact with our nutritionists. I mean, that's been a big game changer, is our nutrition on our farm. And the ozone is a 100% backup if we get an animal with an ailment that the vets cannot figure out, or a chronic one. Made a lot of difference.
Yes, sure sounds like it. And I'm wondering, for people that are now having these movable slaughterhouses in the back of trucks, I wonder if anyone's using ozone to clean those.
That would be a very good idea. There again, the peroxide, I think, would be the thing, because it's an O3 and it's more stable than your ozone water.
Right, but I mean, you could just close them up overnight and do the ozone overnight.
Correct.
And ready to rock.
Right. That's a very good disinfectant. Like I said, it kills all bacteria, all funguses, all molds. Nothing can grow.
Yes. I hope people who know you have been able to follow suit. And what a brilliant use for ozone on the farm. Thank you for being so innovative and for sharing the information today.
Oh, we're still learning. We never stop going to school.
Never stop, period, right?
Right. That's also true.
Yeah. Well, Donna, is there anything else you'd like to say in closing?
I am just grateful to be out here in the country. And we do have very good neighbors. And we do every once in a while have a neighbor, hey, can I bring a calf over?
No
or
doubt.
Something like that, you know, for us to help out. But God has blessed us a great deal with the people we've met on the farm and through this ozone. We have learned a lot from a lot of people, and we've met some pretty amazing people through it.
Indeed. Thanks so much, Donna. I know you're busy, so I appreciate your time.
No, it's about a half hour to milking time.
Many thanks to Stephanie and Blake Alexander and to Donna Feynman for sharing today and for being that resource we all need as we grow into stronger communities. And if you'd like information on the ozone equipment, You can find that as well as anything related to what we're doing here. Our website is cultivatedaudio.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being here and for helping make here where we all want to be.